I remember my mother, when I got over to Eswatini, she was like, okay, you've worked in Congress. Now you're doing the Peace Corps. When are you going to go to law school? She kept reminding me, like, this is your dream and you need to pursue it. And I would push her away and say, well, maybe it's not meant for me. It didn't happen in 2005 when I thought it was supposed to happen. Maybe it's just not meant to be. But having that rock or your friends, your parents, or whoever it is that's your support system reminding you of something that you know that was important to you to do despite a discouraging moment is so helpful and so needed.
You're listening to Ambition Out Loud, the podcast for ambitious women tired of being underestimated and undervalued at work. Together, we're tackling workplace sexism, our own insecurities and self-doubt, and getting practical advice to move our careers forward. I'm your host, Nicole Magoo, and I'm an ambitious woman.
Swing. You should have seen that final show. I'm gonna go down swinging, and long after I am gone, when you hear that melody, you'll still remember me. That's how this girl is gonna carry on.
Hello, everyone. Today, I am honored to have Felicia Woods with us. Felicia L. Woods is a director of federal relations at the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. In this role, she develops and executes strategies to ensure that federal legislation, regulation, and other initiatives promote access to preventative services and quality affordable care for people living with cancer, survivors, and those at risk for cancer. Felicia previously served as counsel to former U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill on the U.S. Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, and as the health counsel on the U.S. Senate Special Committee on Aging. Before working in the U.S. Senate, Felicia served as a non-formal education volunteer in the U.S. Peace Corps in Flangano, Eswatini, which is formerly known as the Kingdom of Swaziland. She also worked as a healthcare legislative assistant to former U.S. Congressman Russ Carnahan. Felicia is originally from Memphis, Tennessee. She received her BA in psychology and Master of Social Work from St. Louis University and her JD from the University of South Carolina. She's currently serving as vice chair on the Fairfax County Commission for Women, where she represents the Providence District. And she stays connected to her roots as part of the Ladies of Memphis Book Club. Thank you so much for joining us today, Felicia.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So I'd really love to jump in and just get started with how you found yourself working in politics. Could you give us a little bit of your backstory and what brought you to this career path?
Sure. It was, you know, one of those serendipitous moments where I was waiting to get my practicum credits at the St. Louis University, pursuing my Master's of Social Work. And I was told, you know, you have to have internship credits in order to move on to the next stage. And I was thinking, hey, I really want to maybe volunteer on a campaign. And how can I do that and also get my practicum credits too? Well, look, behold, I was in the stairwell actually walking towards one of my classes and saw a flyer that said, hey, get practicum credits working for Representative Carnahan, and this will count towards your internship. And I, you know, took the number down, called, and from that moment on in 2006, it introduced me to the world of politics, where I led a volunteer campaign and really was able to talk to the congressman about the needs that he wanted to get done in Missouri. And from just being able to help him, I got a job here in DC in 2008. And from there, I started working as a healthcare LA. And it really just spiraled, you know, just from doing that phone call that led me to, you know, working on the campaign and knocking on doors, eventually led me to Capitol Hill. So that's kind of like, that's the impetus of getting started working in politics.
And how did, was this a natural evolution? I think when we've talked before, you know, I remember you making a comment that it wasn't exactly a linear path for you. And I think that's really important for people to hear and understand. You know, so many times we think I'm going to do A and that's going to lead to B and that's going to lead to C. And that's not always true in reality. What was that like for you?
Yeah, that's so true. I honestly, after I finished college at St. Louis University, I was like, you know, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to go to law school. I'm going to do a gap year where I served as an AmeriCorps. But in that gap year, I planned to study for the LSAT. And, you know, I had my career planned out already. Well, you know, sometimes life throws you a curveball. And I got one of the lowest scores on my LSAT. And from that low score, I didn't get accepted into any law school that I applied to. So being 22, 23, that's a heart-wrenching moment. It was one of my first stings of rejection, not being able to go and pursue a law school career like I thought I would. And I had to regroup. It was a moment where I remember feeling very sad and depressed. And my mother kind of just helped me to be like, you can do what you want to do. You just have to chart a different course. And so I started researching, how can I be involved in the law, but not necessarily pursuing a law degree? And from that, social work came about. As you know, there's different paths in social work. You can be an organizer or you can work in policy. Additionally, you can do traditional where you're doing clinical work in a hospital setting or outpatient counselor setting. And I chose grassroots organizing. And St. Louis University had a track where you could do community grassroots organizing. And that was my way to connect policy and law without having a law degree. And so from that moment, I said, you know, I'm going to still be involved in the law. I just won't have that JD. And it was good at that age to be able to learn how to regroup and we're resilient and we can come up with different ways to pursue our dreams.
Yeah, that's so key. But you did still eventually go on to get your law degree, right? You have a JD. So what was that like for you going from, okay, I'm regrouping, I'm going to get this social work, I'm going to start grassroots advocating, but knowing that this is still your long-term plan, how did you sort of rally your spirits to stay the course, even if it was not going to go unfold the way you thought?
It took a while for me to really face that rejection again. I always had the fear that if I apply again, I won't be accepted again. And it was a hard fear to get over. It took a lot of prayer, a lot of introspection, and really just putting yourself out there. I had worked in Congress for I believe 3.5 years. And I'd also done a year or so of service for the U.S. Peace Corps over in Eswatini. And I remember my mother, when I got over to Eswatini, she was like, okay, you've worked in Congress. Now you're doing the Peace Corps. When are you going to go to law school? She kept reminding me, like, this is your dream and you need to pursue it. And I would push her away and say, well, maybe it's not meant for me. It didn't happen in 2005 when I thought it was supposed to happen. Maybe it's just not meant to be. But having that rock or your friends, your parents, or whoever it is that's your support system reminding you of something that you know that was important to you to do despite a discouraging moment is so helpful and so needed. And she pushed me. And so I ended up applying while I was serving in the Peace Corps. Talk about waiting until you not really have the resources that are available to you, like a scanner or, you know, high-speed internet to really apply for law school. I persevered and I used those scores that were not that great to get into school. And luck be have it, I got into the University of South Carolina and I started in August of 2012 and graduated May of 2015 and passed the bar. And that was something that I never thought would happen.
Awesome. I didn't know that part about your mom pushing you. I do remember, though, you saying that you come from this amazing group of powerhouse women. And I think you have a really cool story about your Aunt Phyllis also helping you with an internship in law school.
Yes. So my Aunt Phyllis is a spitfire in herself. She is my dad's fraternal twin. Actually, they were triplets, but unfortunately, one of the babies passed away at birth. But that lady has always been in my corner. No matter what I've tried to pursue, she has been right there. How can I help you? And so in law school, after your first year, you're trying to line up an internship for the summer. And, you know, even in law school, I had good grades, but not exceptional grades, not to the point where the law firms were beating down my door by any means. So I remember talking to her about, I'm really searching for an internship, and I really don't know if I'm going to find one in South Carolina. Maybe I should come home to Memphis. And little to my knowing, my aunt was already on the case. She started cold calling firms across the country. And she called up a couple of law firms in California, some in New York, just picking up the phone and speaking to the paralegals and receptionists, and sometimes even lawyers, and saying, hey, my niece is a student at University of South Carolina, and she needs an internship. You need to hire her. And, you know, honestly, I did get two interviews out of her cold calling. And one guy, I remember interviewing with him, this was a person in Memphis, he said, I just had to interview you because never ever have I known a person or an aunt to pick up the phone and cold call a law firm. You must be exceptional if your aunt is willing to do that. So I just wanted to talk to you. Ultimately, I chose a plaintiff's firm down in South Carolina to do my internship. But because of her, I was able to walk into some doors that I didn't know were even going to open.
That's amazing. And I think it's really exemplary of one of the kind of key themes that we've talked about in your past and you're coming to this point, which is just that is such a bold action, right? Picking up the phone and calling law firms on behalf of your niece. And you've said, you know, in the past that your girlfriends think you're really bold and you don't see yourself that way. But this idea of like really boldly stepping up and advocating for yourself and owning your own power seems to be a theme that continues, you know, despite situations not working out the way you initially thought. It just continues to be a theme throughout your life. How did you and these amazing women you come from get to be so bold and own your power so easily? Or maybe it's not easy. Maybe it just perceives to be easy.
You know, I think it comes from on both sides of my family, we are rooted in our faith. So we rely a lot on prayer and rely a lot on family support. And both my grandmothers on my dad's side and my mother's side, when our families joined together through my parents' marriage, they basically said, we are all one. And those two ladies, one is still living, my mother's mom, my grandmother, Fanny, and my dad's mother, my grandmother, Elizabeth, were very close and kind of just taught us the importance of staying true to ourselves. They went through a lot of hardships in their lives. They went through abuse in some instances, but remained able to keep the family together and to instill into their daughters, especially the importance of being bold and speaking out and owning your truth. And also it kind of trickled to, I will also include that my grandmothers were very close to their sisters. So my great aunts were influential in my life. Specifically, I will talk about my Aunt Bessie, who was my dad's mother's sister. My Aunt Bessie kind of helped me when I was younger, when I was struggling with the fact that I am darker complected African-American woman. And growing up, I really didn't like my skin color. And I'm just being frank about that. And I remember going to her and being like, I don't think that I'm as pretty as everybody else because of my skin complexion. And my Aunt Bessie was dark just like me. And she was like, baby, you are beautiful. And you have to own your beauty. And you're smart. And when you put all that together, that makes you a powerhouse. And you're able to go in a room and talk to people and they respect you because of how smart you are, but also see you because of who you are. And it's not all about how you look. It's about being able to carry yourself and being smart and educated and being bold and able to step out on faith when it comes to anything that you do. And so all of those women kind of worked with my aunts and on down to my cousins. And now, you know, everyone has started their own families. But because of those four rocks we have really relied on to just build our strength. And that's how we as a family stay connected. And I just appreciate the fact that I've had them in my life to just push me to become who I am.
Such a beautiful story. And I know there's a lot of women listening that are feeling pretty jealous right now, because that's just what a gift to be able to have such a strong group of women in your life that have not only, you know, individually been strong, but been able to build each other's strength and borrow on each other's strength when they needed it to.
Yeah.
And pass it forward for generations to come.
Definitely. I really appreciate having that. You know, it's, and as we get older, of course, people pass away, but you remember the conversations that you've had. And I just distinctly remember a lot of the relationships that I've had with them over the years. And it just, it warms my heart when I can reflect back on something. If I'm going through something in the now, I can reflect back on something from the past that my aunt or grandmother said, or my cousin may have said. And it's like, wow, okay, this is what she meant by that. And I can push forward knowing that I'm honoring them.
Where do you think, I mean, you've talked about faith, that's a big part of it. I'm assuming just from some of our previous conversations that your family didn't necessarily come from a really cushy, wealthy background. How do you, is it the faith that helped them come through? You know, we have so many assumptions that wealth, privilege, status are what create power in this world, but you're talking about really enduring power, right? Not superficial power.
Right.
How do you, outside of the faith, what other roles or what other situations and circumstances might have contributed to just this amazing group of women you have?
Well, my family on both sides came from sharecroppers. We really didn't have much on either side of the family. I would say education-wise, I'm probably the most educated on both sides of the family, but especially when it comes to the women. My mother's mom was a maid for the majority of her life with I think a third grade education. And my dad's mother, believed she was a nurse, just a certified nurse assistant. She did spend a lot of her time also working as a housemaid or nanny. So we didn't really come from money or any type of power or influence. It was really being able to pull yourself up, but pulling yourself up, I say, from relying on community and relying on each other. I listened to some of the stories about my mother when she was growing up living in South Memphis, where it was just very community oriented. Everyone went to church together. Everyone went to school together. Everyone played together. And if one family was suffering, another family would stand in the gap with them. And even the same with my dad. They lived, both grew up in South Memphis, but in different parts of the area. And so they relied on their family strength to get them to where they are. And that power, I think, comes from within, of seeing the struggle that both their mothers went through and wanting more and desiring more. So when I was growing up and my brother was growing up, we were told, you're going to college. And what you do from there, you make the adult decisions of how you want to proceed and pursue your life. And I always take my faith and also exercising wisdom to make those decisions. So yeah, it definitely didn't come from power and money, but it really came from just internal and community work together to build the family that we have.
Hey, do you guys remember Marsha from the Accidentally Ambitious episode in season one? Well, her Hideaways has launched and I've got her back to tell you a little bit about it. This is something I believe in so much, I had to go ahead and become a subscriber right away. So Marsha, tell me about how many points I have built up and what I can expect to get out of them.
First off, I wanted to thank you so much for being our first ever package purchaser. And then you are our second subscriber. So thank you so much for supporting my small business and supporting you by subscribing. You have 3,300 points, as you know, but your listeners may not know. With points, you can use them either for a night stay. You can have a chef come and prepare a meal with you. You can actually have them prepare the meal for you. You can have an on-site massage like you did during your first Hideaway. Or you could get a manicure or pedicure in town with one of our approved vendors.
I have to say, right now, Nicole is really excited that I made that decision to become a subscriber, because I just know that, like, with all this time spent with my kids during the pandemic, I cannot wait to get out of my house and have, like, a little bit of alone mom time to, like, clear my head and think and, yeah, all the things. I can't wait. So I got to book that with you because clearly the whole point of, like, set it and forget it, self-care staycations, is that I got to take advantage of the points. So that's happening very soon.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I love about the subscription is that even if you can't foresee in the immediate future of doing a hideaway, you're building every single month. You're getting that automatic debit come out and that gets you 600 points. It's $57 for 600 points. And then you're building. Do you have anything to offer your listeners, Nicole?
Absolutely. If they use the code AMBITIONOUTLOUD, we'll hook them up with a discount.
Yep. You are our first affiliate and we are so excited to have it where you are rewarding your listeners with something that will really help them unwind, relax, be taken care of, not take care of themselves because we take care of everything for them. That's the whole point of Her Hideaways. So thank you so much, Nicole, for being such a raving fan of you. We appreciate you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Do it, ladies. You need it. That's such a different model of success than we hear, honestly, at this point, kind of shoved down our throats in right. A lot of the recent dialogue. You know, when we hear people talk about pulling yourself up by their bootstraps, what they're usually talking about is like, you are hyper independent. You somehow managed to figure out how to make it through this life all on your own. You don't need help from anyone. You don't give help unless, you know, maybe it's a close family member. But what you're talking about is strength at the community level and taking a, like, really flipping that paradigm on its head. And everything is coming from our collective strength.
Exactly. I mean, I think about, like, my church, and there are instrumental women who I grew up with in my church, and they're my mom's, I call them her ladies. Like, they all stick together. And, you know, they, even now during the pandemic, they started a prayer call, or they would talk to each other and pray for each other three times a week. But those ladies have been in my life ever since I was probably 6 or 7. And I remember one, I was looking for an internship when I was in college, and I wanted something to do in the summer, and I couldn't think of anything to do. But one of the ladies worked at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center. And so she talked to somebody who was administering the Ronald E. McNair Scholars Program. I applied late, but I got in. And because of her, I became connected to one of the most phenomenal endocrinologists in Memphis. And I was able to sit with her and learn about the endocrine system and learn so much about being a doctor. This was an African-American woman doctor who, you know, she eventually started treating my grandmother. So it's like those connections that help create who you are. And because of that doctor, I decided to go into health policy. And it's like all of those things connect back to that one church member who started it off. That's the community collective. Like, I would be remiss not to give her that credit for helping me spiral into my career because of that relationship.
That seems to be a perfect segue, actually, because I know that you mentioned previously that when you were 18, you never could have imagined yourself working on Capitol Hill. But health policy, politics has played a really big role in your career over the most recent years. How did your view of yourself and your mind frame around politics have to change for you to be able to make that leap? Or did it not change and it just kind of, you just followed one next right step and you ended up there? What was that like for you?
I think it was the latter. I just followed one step and then just moved forward. I distinctly remember, so after I did my internship in 2006 with Representative Carnahan and helped, he won his 2006 campaign, I was like, what do I do from here? Because I graduated, I had one more year left for my MSW. So I was going to graduate in August of 2007. But I really got intrigued with the world of politics based off that working with him that short few months during that 2006 election cycle. So I ended up interning in his congressional district office. So when you go from the campaign world world, you're really all about reelecting the member. But the district office is truly, in my opinion, where the rubber meets the road, because the district office does a lot of constituent services. So that's where constituents call in and say, you know, I'm having an issue with my Social Security appeal, or I'm having an issue with my Veterans Affairs benefits, my VA benefits. Can you help me, Congressman? Or I'm trying to get into one of the military academies. Congressman, will you sign a recommendation letter? So you're really doing the work of the community. And so from there, I said, oh, this is something that I really want to do, because I see how the influence that a member of Congress has to bring resources to his community, his or her community. And so from there, I was like, yeah, I really want to work in politics. I really want to work in policy. And I love how the two connect. And I remember going to him and asking him for a job. I was like, Congressman, I really want to work for you, and I want to work in your St. Louis office. And he said, well, Felicia, we don't have anything available. And that kind of hit me hard. I was like, gosh, I really want to do this. So I had to kind of figure out, well, what am I going to do in the interim? I need a job. I'm about to graduate. And I promise you, within 3 months after me graduating, he called out of the blue and said, hey, we have a job for you, but it's in DC. Are you willing to move to DC? And my mom has a motto, we don't miss opportunities, we seize opportunities. When the door opens, you walk through it. And I immediately said yes. And from that moment on, I have been working in politics and working in policy.
Wow, what an important motto. We don't miss opportunities, we seize opportunities.
Yes.
Man, that's a good one.
Yeah, she's really good with that. She is always like, if a door opens, you know, you pray about it and you seek wisdom, you seek faith, but don't close the door because of fear. And, you know, I had never lived in DC. I've been to DC one time when I was, I think, 13. But I said, you know, I think I was 25 or 26 at the time. You only live once. So you want to live a life where you are pursuing things and not allowing yourself to be held back, especially if it's in your heart to do.
I feel like your faith has something to say about that, right? Because I can imagine, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but if that door's opening in front of you, your faith tells you there's a reason the door's there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is a great one. So you are on Capitol Hill now. You are there because you had the audacity to walk up to a congressman and ask him for a job,
yeah.
Which is amazing in and of itself. I don't want that to go unnoted. And what is it like living in DC on your own?
Living in DC, well, this is my second time living in DC. So I was here from 08 to 11, left for Peace Corps and law school, and then came back. You know, DC, I enjoy. I appreciate the evolution of DC and how it's so many worlds merging together, so many brilliant minds coming here and creating change. And I just love the energy of the city, the energy of the people. And it's one reason why I'm continued to be drawn here. My mom always jokes whenever I come home for the holidays, she's like, when are you going back to your home? I'm like, Memphis is my home. No, DC is your home. That's where your heart is. And it really just has been overwhelming being here. And working on Capitol Hill was very overwhelming for me, because just the awe of being in the buildings, of being in the Capitol, walking around in a place where enslaved people helped to build, you know, that's a legacy for me, because I'm like, I am here where somebody who was helping to build this place couldn't even imagine or see that a person like me could be walking these halls and helping to affect change and create policies and create laws that would affect those across the land. And so it's heartwarming to walk in that building, and it gives me chills every time I do, because I know I'm doing the right thing. I know that I'm there for a purpose and for a reason, and that's to help others who grew up probably similarly situated as me, but also to make sure that people like my grandmothers and my mothers and my dad and brother are fully taken care of. So, you know, that the energy of DC is why I'm so drawn here. But the work that we do and how it affects people across this land is the reason that keeps me here.
I can imagine a lot of women in your shoes. I hear from a lot of women that walking those halls and knowing all that history and also knowing all the power at play in those halls would give them imposter syndrome and make them shrink a little bit. How did you fight that? Did you have that feeling? And if you did, how did you fight that within your own mind?
So I deal and battle with imposter syndrome all the time. And how I fight it is by picking up the phone and calling some of my girlfriends who are like, no, 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 we're not doing that. You have to be able to, I do believe in going back to just my faith. I do believe in praying about those things or writing down what is causing this feeling. Why do you think that you're inadequate? Why do you think that you're not going to be able to accomplish something? And channeling that and doing your best to make sure that you do overcome it. It can be a struggle. You know, it can definitely cause some people to shrink. I haven't had moments where I've shrunk in that. I've tried to use that as an opportunity to keep challenging myself to grow, because I think the further you stretch yourself, in some instances, the less you'll have that, because you're able to really say, well, I've done X, Y, Z, and that worked out fine. And so for me, I take inventory. You know, I stepped out on faith and came to DC and it worked out. I left DC and went over to live in Eswatini, in a place that I'd never been to, and lived in a rural area, and it worked out. I am a firm believer that everywhere that you want to go, God has already been. So that place has been prepared for you. So you just walk in that faith and walk in that beauty. And even if you're not one who believes in God, what I would encourage you to do is believe in yourself, believe in that inner person, that gut feeling that's teaching you that's showing you and directing your path, because you're going to be okay. And it's okay sometimes to be like, can I do this? But take that can I do it and turn it to I will do it.
So it's hard for some people, I think, to imagine what you just said is anywhere I've been was prepared for me to be there. That's mm-hmm. a really, really strong statement. And it's one that I can see being incredibly power giving, but you're operating in places, you're in Congress, you're on Capitol Hill. These are not places that are known to be friendly and warm, welcoming to women. And women in many cases are significantly outnumbered. What is that like? Tell us a little bit about, I mean, clearly that inner strength is part of what helps you, you know, walk through those doors every day. But when you're sitting on bodies that are supporting the U.S. Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, I can't imagine that, you know, they're welcoming you with open arms as a woman and also.
Yeah, you do have that. You do have to overcome a lot of battles, and it can be a struggle. And when you're battling with that, I'm a very assertive person, and I always have been. Now I have to take it back to first grade a long, 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 long time ago. When I remember my teacher, Mrs. Dotson, put me in a group with all boys. We were doing group work. And she put me in a group with all boys. And I came home and I complained to my mom. I said, Mom, Ms. Dotson put me in a group with all boys. None of my friends were in this group. And it just upset me because I don't really want to be with them. I want to be with my friends. And so my mom, being my advocate at that time, went to the teacher and told her, you know, Felicia didn't appreciate being in a group with all men, all boys. And the teacher said, I put her there because I know she can handle them. And so my mom told me that. And from that age on, I remember being, when I'm in places where I'm the only woman of color or the only woman in a setting with sometimes all white men, I remember that statement. I can handle this. I can assert myself. I can make sure that I am heard. And when I'm not heard, or if I feel like an individual is overlooking me, I will call them out. That's one part of coming from a very bold group of women in my family, is that I can step up and say, hey, no, this isn't right. And do it in a very cordial way, very professional way, and not in a manner where, you know, I'm being rude, but really just expressing how I'm feeling and making sure that my voice is heard. So when I'm in a room as a woman of color by myself, or, you know, I'm happy to call a person out if I feel like my voice isn't being heard. And I think we have to have the courage to step up and say, you know what, I don't feel like you're listening to me, and here's why. And being able to explain that it's important and valuable to hear the voices of everyone in the room. It can be difficult sometimes because you may be met with opposition, but it's important to make sure that your word and that your words are heard. And so I rely on being assertive. I'm never rude, but I'm able to get my point across. And I think that that's important working on Capitol Hill, working as a lobbyist, or just in general, when you're in a room filled with people who may not look like you or are not of the same gender or sex as you, you have to be willing to express and use your voice to, and raise your voice to make sure that you are heard.
I know that you've said various times that you came from such a strong group of women that this makes perfect sense listening to your story, but that you didn't initially think that women's empowerment was much of a topic for conversation, right? And coming from such a strong group of women who already in many ways felt empowered, it sounds like that makes perfect sense. But that through your career, you started to see it as being something that we needed to take a little bit more seriously. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think right now, women's empowerment, and honestly, the focus, my change really happened when I served in Peace Corps and seeing the strength of the women over in Eswatini and how they were building a community and very instrumental in the education of the community and of the children. And I think right now, women's empowerment is so important. We need to be at the head and at the helm of a lot of discussions and a lot of conversations, at the head and at the helm of organizations and nonprofits and all types of businesses, because our ability as women to handle and manage so many things, from family to work to our personal social lives, we're able to juggle so much and be successful at it too. And honing in and valuing the importance of each other, we need to be able to reach out to each other and empower each other and encourage each other and strengthen one another. And the only way we can do that is through women's empowerment, through groups like you mentioned my book club that I'm part of. It's called The Ladies of Memphis. And we encourage each other. We're there for each other. We're strong towers in our communities to make sure that we're looking out. Having a person on your six is so important. And I just appreciate how Congress is even changing. More women are being elected into Congress, more women of color also. And it's just phenomenal to see the leadership that is coming as a result of women being empowered and included. Some of the movements that I've seen in the last couple of years, it's just really making me be like, yes, now is our time. We are stepping out there, being more assertive and letting the world know that enough is enough and that women can succeed and women can lead. And here we are, and we're ready to do it.
Do you see that evolving in any way in your own career? Do you have any plans to possibly, you have this really impressive resume and background. You bring a really important perspective that is not obviously being heard. You know, we've had such a tumultuous summer, and it's made it so clear that we do need to embrace and bring in more perspectives and more voices, and especially more voices from women of color. How do you see that playing out for yourself in the next few years?
Well, I will say, from just a lot of my career, I've always told people, even when I was working on Capitol Hill, I want to run for office one day. And I wasn't saying that just to say it. I do feel like we need more women of color in on the Hill, but we also need more women of color represented statewide and locally. And for me, it's important to be able to share your story and to be able to have somebody making decisions and as an elected official that will benefit the community. And I have seen people come to Congress, you know, get elected, and you're wondering, what was their motivation to become an elected official? What brought them here? And so for me, I want to be able to make sure that I'm executing policy that will benefit my grandmother or benefit my mom in a way, or girls in the future, if I have children, to make sure that they are able to succeed and have everything that they ever wanted in life. And in order to do that, you need to have people at the helm who are ready to make hard decisions on the basis of improving the community locally, state, and federally. And I hope to one day run for office because I see the importance of increasing and making sure we have healthcare, making sure our education systems are functioning and running in a way that are serving our not only the students but also the teachers who are creating brilliant minds, but also looking at our transportation and infrastructure and how that helps with driving forces and making sure that we're all able to be connected to each other. I think that policy is important, and I value the need for us to have folks in office that are looking at policies critically to make sure that they benefit everyone and not just one group of people, but equally benefiting everybody. And so that's one of the reasons why I've always said I do want to run for office, because I have had the community experience. I've also had the Hill experience as well as the advocacy experience. So having all three and the education, so having all four would make me be an important member of whatever legislative body I choose to run for.
Well, keep us informed, because you know you've got a community of women here that are rooting for you, and we will do what we can to help support you on your path there.
We know that the work of anti-racism requires commitment to a movement, not just the moment. The Nardi Media Black Lives Matter Book Club amplifies Black voices through both fiction and nonfiction storytelling, making it easier to stay engaged and intentional about your growth in the areas of anti-racism and social justice. Book Club members looking to take their commitment a step further can add the BLM Book Club Companion Box, created by Ambition Unboxed. The Companion Box helps you put your money where your mouth is by aligning your economic power with your social values. Each box includes that month's book club pick, plus a selection of seasonal products featuring Black-owned businesses. Learn more at ambitionunboxed.com or by clicking the link in the show notes.
You know, given your experience with Capitol Hill, one thing in particular that has come up fairly recently, I think you have a really valuable insight and perspective that you could share with us on, because so many of us are just hypothesizing about this, but you actually have worked on Capitol Hill and you know these systems and these processes pretty well. The executive order that came down recently from President Trump, basically banning any use of terminology that supports topics around diversity and inclusion and equity and training on these topics. What do you see as being the biggest dangers and ramifications to some of that executive order that those of us that aren't involved in DC life as intimately as you are might not even be aware are going to have long-term ramifications and effects?
I feel like it could be detrimental in how we really are approaching this social justice movement that's going on right now and educating people about the past. Honestly, I think in order for us to move forward and as a country and as a nation, we have to examine the past hurts and the past wrongs. And teaching about diversity, teaching about inclusion and race and ethnicity is so important for people to be able to understand their own bias or their own prejudices. And even for people of color, it's vital and important. And reading that EO, it was very scary to me because I wondered, well, how will this trickle down into our private sector? Will the private sector look at what the executive order says and say, hey, well, we won't do diversity training? And so that could dismantle all of the work that many companies have been doing when it comes to diversity and inclusion and educating people in order to move the needle and move past, not necessarily move past, but strengthen our community and heal some hurts that are there. And it's just a scary time. And I know that there are a lot of organizations that are trying to fight this executive order and are building capacity where they're able to step out and say, hey, no, this is wrong. And we need to do a better job as a government. Because the government's in our government leads by example. The government is the leader. So for the government to say this is important or this is wrong, that is scary for the private sector, but also the community, because it's a slap in the face to everybody who has been marching for years and dedicated their lives to diversity and inclusion and engagement and equity, and just saying, nope, we're not about that. We're going to focus on keeping everything the way it is. That's harmful. Our society can't evolve without learning from our past hurts in order to protect and fix the things that need to happen in the future. So I'm nervous and I'm very scared. And I hope that in some way this can be overturned.
Yeah, it really strikes me. You know, we've talked a lot on this episode about the importance of sharing your story mm-hmm. and of owning your voice. And it really strikes me as an attempt to silence people,
yeah.
an attempt to yeah. shut off those stories, prevent them from being shared, prevent a generation of people coming up behind us from being educated on these issues, erase things, right?
Right. It's like, oh no, let's just sweep that under the rug. And it's like, we've done as a country so much sometimes sweeping things under the rug that it has bubbled up. And right now we have to address it. You cannot continue to say, oh no, let's erase that. No, let's move on. That it happened, but that's the past. I'm sorry, 60 years ago, we still have people who lived through Jim Crow. I had a conversation most recently with my grandmother, who is 84 years old, about segregation. She grew up for the first 12 years of her life, she lived in Mississippi, and then they moved to Memphis. So she grew up through the Jim Crow era. And I asked her, I was like, grandmother, what was it like? And she was just like, you know, I just stayed away from white people. I was afraid. I didn't want to talk to them because they didn't like us. They hated us. And a story that really struck me and it brought tears to my eyes was she said that her mother was a maid and she was living. She went to work with her mother one day, and her mother, it was two boys that lived in the house, two white boys that lived in the house that my great-grandmother was a maid for. And she said, you know, I played with them and they were real nice to me. And I was like, okay. She was like, you know, they were nice because they didn't do anything mean to me. If that's your standard, that's scary. And she's an 84-year-old woman that's still living. She, for an executive order to come out to say, oh, let's erase it. It didn't happen. This woman knows it happened. She was afraid and still is in some respects of white people to this day because of the harm that happened to her as a child. We have to learn from our past in order to build a better future. And if our government is not leading by example, who will lead? Who will lead?
Man, that is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Well, and not only do we need to learn from our mistakes, but, you know, it's not as widely talked about, but the 1965 Voting Rights Act is also being attacked, and there are attempts to dismantle it. So I don't think it's as innocent as, oh, we've moved beyond it. There's definitely more at play there that mm-hmm. I hope people are paying attention to.
Agreed. I do too. And vote.
And vote. Yes, this episode is going to come out before the election. Please let it go to your heart and dwell on it and think about it if you have not already voted early when you cast that vote on election day.
Right.
Well, thank you so much, Felicia, for coming on this episode. You know, if anything, this executive order just reinstates the importance of people being brave enough to do things like come on this podcast and share their story and have these conversations in the places and the spaces where we're still able to have them, and to keep building that grassroots momentum and, you know, pushing for the culture we want to see at the top. So I really appreciate you taking the time today to share your story with our listeners.
No worries. I'm happy to be here and happy to share my story, and appreciate you having this podcast and this safe space for people to express and be able to talk about who they are and how our lives are all important. And having that safe space is just truly, truly great.
Please keep us informed on your plans, especially as you get closer to knowing exactly where you fit in this landscape of political office in the future, so that we can continue to show up and support you. And if our followers want to go check you out, get to know you, reach out to you, follow you, where can they find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Phil Wu. It's at PhylWoo, or on Instagram at Phil No Insta, because I was kind of opposed to Instagram for a while. So my friends was always tagging me at Phil No Insta. So I created it as my Instagram. So at Phil No Insta. And then Facebook is Phil Woods, PhylWoods.
All right. And I'll make sure to put all those in the show notes for everyone so they can make their way back to them in a safe manner in case you're driving or something like that. But again, thank you so much for the time, Felicia. And we will see everyone again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our episode for today. Thank you so much for spending the time with us. If you found today's episode helpful, please pull out your phone and share the link with one or two friends that would also benefit from hearing it. If you really loved it, please leave a review in iTunes to help others find the podcast. Itching to meet other ambitious women? Connect with members of our community online at the Ambition Unboxed Facebook group. Ambition Out Loud is produced by Cultivate Inc. LLC. This episode was edited by our new editor, Kristen Sullivan. Welcome to the team, Kristen. Today's music is by Steve Rice Music. New episodes will be available every other week. Until next time, remember, your ambition is a beautiful thing.
I'm gonna go down swinging. There'll be a tale to tell. Like a boxer in the ring, I'll give my everything until I hear that final bell.